welcome everybody. This is a August 25th meeting of the Joint Interim Committee on Transportation, Preservation, and Modernization. That's a big title.
August 31st.
Yeah, I always read the wrong title here. August 31st, 2016.
There you go.
An announcement first?
Mr. Chair, we have available for persons who need it Spanish translation of the meeting. Our translator is here. If anybody is in need of Spanish translation or would like so, we have headsets. Just raise your hand.
Las personas que hablan solamente español, si pueden por favor levantar su mano para que les demos un set de audífonos para poder interpretar el idioma español. Si hay alguien aquí que necesita interpretación a español, por favor levante la mano bien alto para que lo veamos.
Okay, well.
5,000 more languages we can use too.
We try to be accommodating.
Really?
Okay, this committee was established by the legislative leadership, the Speaker of the House, and the President of the Senate to get a perspective of Oregonians on what you see the transportation problems and needs are, and determine to what extent people are willing to provide some funding to do that. One of the things that we've discovered is that with the limited growth in the gas tax and other fees, is we're not able to keep up at either the state level or the cities and counties with the maintenance need to preserve the roads that are there. Plus, we have other issues that are out there, planning for the potential of an earthquake, huge earthquake, and what that would cost us, and preserving the bridges and roads. So that's kind of the discussion. This is our seventh meeting. We've been, this committee is composed of legislators from pretty much every corner and section of the state of Oregon. So there's a good cross-reference here to give regional perspectives. And we've made the rounds. We've pretty much covered the state. We've got three left after tonight. We've got a coastal meeting, one up on the west side of Portland, and then the Central Valley area, Central Willamette Valley area. So we're trying to do the best, and the idea would be is to determine if there is a transportation package need. I think there's a presumption that there is based on the governor's work before the governor's vision panel. And so that's what we're going to do. The process tonight is I've got a sign-up list. We're going to go in the order that people signed up. We're going to try to do start out with 3 minutes a speaker, so hopefully we can get through everybody in the 2 hours, and that should work. I would like to recognize that we have two of the members of the Oregon Transportation Commission here with us tonight, Commissioner Morgan in the back, and Commissioner Lohman. There he is over there. We were right over there a minute ago. And we also have Carmen Ford, the governor's transportation policy advisor. Not sure where.
And former OTC. Yeah.
And somewhere around here was currently one of your representatives, Peter Buckley, Representative Buckley. I don't see him. He may have already left. We also have former OTC chair, Stuart Foster, here. So welcome to all of you, and thank you for attending tonight. All righty. I will, just for the record, people, if you haven't seen this, it's a document that was prepared by the Governor's Transportation Vision Committee. They spent about 2 years going and talking to people and looking at the issues. This is a good reference document. You can find it online at either the governor's website, this committee's website, or the Oregon Department of Transportation. So it's widely available. Has a lot of information on different funding sources that different states use and what those would mean to Oregon, as well as a good description of the problem statement of what's there. So I would recommend, if you're interested, to take a look at that. All right, so we're going to get down to it then. And I should say the 3 minutes when you're talking, we push the button, and when it turns red, that's the end of 3 minutes. We would ask that you then close your comments and give other people a chance. First two speakers we're going to have, Michael Zarzynski. I always say your name wrong, Mike. Zarzynski and John Vile. Oh, yeah. Before you start, I forgot, we'll do member introduction very quickly. And we'll start on the far end. Carl?
Carl Wilson, State Rep, District 3. That would be Grants Pass, Cave Junction, Williams. Nice to see you. Thanks.
Sal Escobel, Medford, District 6.
Chris Edwards, State Senator from Eugene.
Rod Monroe, State Senator from Mid Multnomah County and Northern Clackamas County.
Betsy Johnson, State Senator, Northwest Oregon, Tillamook, Clatsop of Columbia, a little Multnomah, and a little Washington.
Brian Boquist, State Senator, five rural portions, counties in portions of the Willamette Valley.
Lee Byers, State Senator, representing Central Lane and Linn counties.
Cliff Bentz, State Representative, District 60, which includes Burns, Baker City, John Day, and Lakeview, and all points in between.
John Lively, State Representative, District 12, which is the city of Springfield.
Good evening. I'm Representative Greg Smith from District 57, which includes Milton Freewater and Hermiston and Stanfield and Umatilla and Umatilla County, Morrow County, Gillum County, Sherman County, and the very, very best parts of Wasco County. I also represent the Port of Morrow, Port of Umatilla, Port of Arlington, and Port of the Dalles. Thank you so much for your hospitality this evening and all day today. It's been wonderful.
And joining us tonight, my name is Susan McLean, and I'm the representative from West Washington County, Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove.
I'm Barbara Smith Warner. I'm the state representative from House District 45, which is Northeast Portland.
Is that it? Okay.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry to come in just a minute late. My name's Caddy McEwen. I represent House District 9, which is Coos Bay to Yahats. We go, we have Coos, Douglas Lane, and Lincoln counties. I represent four ports, Representative Smith. And I'm delighted to co-chair this committee with Senator Beyer. You've been delightful today in hosting us. We feel very welcome, and this is our seventh stop, and we're very happy to be here. So thank you for joining us tonight.
Okay, Counselor.
I would like to thank the committee for taking the time to meet here and listen to our local needs. My name is Michael Zarazinski, and I'm representing the Medford City Council. First of all, I'd like to point out that to the city of Medford, maintenance is a critical component to our transportation system, and a dollar spent today on maintenance can save up to $5 in future maintenance costs. The city would also like to encourage the committee that any future funding package follows the existing 50-30-20 split to ODOT counties and cities, respectively. With that said, the project that we would like to bring to your attention as a regional transportation need is the North Phoenix Road, Foothill Road corridor, and the South Stage Road overcrossing. And in background, the city of Medford is a regional employment, medical, and retail hub that draws traffic trips from a three-county area. One of the key routes into our community is I-5, but that also creates challenges for us. The interstate, coupled with Bear Creek, bifurcates the community into east and west sections and limits connectivity. In addition, we struggle with an over-reliance on the interstate for north-south movement through the city. And considering that a large portion of the interstate through Medford is a seismically vulnerable viaduct, we are at risk of not only north-south movement impediments through the town after a Cascadia seismic event, but could also be limited for east-west travel as well, depending on whether failure of the viaduct impacts connecting arterials below. The regional project we are advocating provides many benefits. Together, they provide redundancy in both east-west connectivity and north-south movement. Specific to the South Stage Road overcrossing, it provides a last-mile freight connection to Harry and David, which would then support the Highway 99 alternate mode transportation corridor by providing a different route for the 9 million parcels currently shipped from that location. When combined with the North Phoenix Foothill Road corridor, both projects protect capacity at both the South Medford and Fern Valley interchanges, which represent $140 million of recent investment. The project aligns with the ODOT regional seismic strategy by providing a stable connection to Highway 140 and subsequently Highway 97 after a catastrophic event. In addition, traffic routing during such a scenario is no longer forced through downtown Medford, which would further create an east-west disconnect for emergency services. Finally, this project clearly supports multiple Oregon highway planning goals. First and foremost, the state and local government will be working together as the city and county have already invested over $17 million in projects supporting the corridor. It also supports the efficient use of public infrastructure and investments by maintaining the mobility and safety of the highway system in two key ways, protecting capacity at existing interchanges and seismic resiliency. Finally, it meets the state goal of enhanced livability and economic competitiveness by supporting regional freight. Beyond creating an alternate route, Another byproduct of this project is the reduction in local trips on the interstate by improved connectivity on the local system. Less cars on the freeway leaves more room for freight traffic and is the most efficient way to effectively increase capacity. Traffic on that on the interstate is anticipated to increase 20% in the next 25 years, and this is a project that can help alleviate that. It was asked earlier what kind of support this project has from the community, and the actual answer is none. The reason being is that they haven't been asked. If you talk to people about the project, they would see the benefit and are supportive of the concept. Whether or not they would open their wallets is a different story. When I look at funding a project such as this, I look at leverage. If we had options to take some of our own money, couple it up with state funds, and meet the required match for a federal grant, then I believe the citizens would understand that value and be supportive. I think that while a great deal of effort is being made to preserve and maintain our infrastructure with the potential transportation package, if we go deeper and ask for support to improve efficiency or enhance capacity, then the voters need to know what they are getting. I believe if they can see where the dollars are going and feel that ODOT is right size to manage the money, they will support increasing revenue. That last part is me speaking for myself and not the council, so can't blame anyone else. I would be happy to answer any questions, and if none, I appreciate the opportunity to speak here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Councilor. Mr. Vile?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Vile, and I'm the Public Works Director for Jackson County. I appreciate the name of this committee, the Transportation Preservation and Modernization Committee, and it's on that topic of preservation that I want to just share a couple of remarks. Before I do that, or as I do that, a quick story. Several years ago, about 20 years ago, I was hired as a district manager for the Oregon Department of Transportation, and my boss took me for a drive. And as we were driving, he asked me, what's the most important thing for a district manager to maintain? Thought about that for a minute, thought the investment in pavements is huge. We need to maintain our pavements. He says, well, that's close, but it's drainage. If you don't take care of drainage, your subgrade gets wet, your road falls apart, and you got to take care of drainage. So we drove a little longer, and he said, well, if drainage is the first priority, what's number two? So I thought, well, now it's pavements. And he said, no, it's drainage. And made the same point. When he asked me the third time, I got it. But his point was this. Maintenance and preservation is not glamorous. You don't do ribbon cuttings on it. It's not fancy. It's not something that often gets you reelected. But it is vitally important that we do it. And the problem is right now, we're struggling in doing it. We are struggling in keeping up. And we are falling further behind. A recent study completed year before last by the Association of Oregon Counties, and looking at all of the counties out there, polling them on what their needs for maintenance and preservation is. So this is the most basic things. This is the drainage kind of an activity. For every dollar that we're spending currently on county roads, we need to spend another 32 cents to take care of the drainage, those most basic of activities. If we bump that up and look at pavement preservation, so now we're overlaying the roads and preserving our pavement, for every dollar that we spent, we need to spend another $1.67. So the needs are great just to simply maintain what we have, and we're falling further and further behind. One of the reasons that we're challenging, that we have a challenge with this, is simply stuff costs more, and we need to be more efficient, and we need to get better. But the market forces are real. When I started this business, we could buy chip seal oil, asphalt emulsion oil for doing chip seals, and we were paying $125 a ton for it. This last year, I was excited when the bid came in at $545 a ton for it. So almost a four-fold increase over a 12-year period. Those kinds of inflationary factors are real, and it causes us to not be able to keep up. So as you do your difficult job, and you do have a difficult job, I encourage you to look at transportation funding solutions that help us solve the drainage problem so we can take care of the infrastructure and provide a sound transportation system for the citizens of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Okay, I'm going to now start calling people up in groups of four so we can move it along. First up, Gary Milliman, Don Brulin, Jeff Gutting, and Gary Sheriff.
Schaff.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Please.
I'm Gary Melliman, city manager for the city of Brookings. Thank you for coming to Southern Oregon and hearing about our ideas. In 2014, the city of Brookings developed a transportation pavement management plan, which identified a $300,000 annual need over a period of 10 years for street maintenance and accessibility needs. In 2015, the voters of Brookings enacted a 4-cent per gallon fuel tax, which generates $282,000 a year in the first year. That was a guess because there's no information available from state sources as to how much gas tax the state collects in our community. Some system to assist local agencies needs to be developed in that regard. We were generating $137,000 a year on a sewer and water utility surcharge for street maintenance. And as a result of the enactment of the fuel tax, that 137 was traded in for 282. I think it was a good trade. And the citizens of Brookings, I believe, think so too. Our view is that the state should offer incentives to cities and counties to enact local transportation taxes, either through a tax on fuel sales or other local fees, such as utility surcharge or a property tax. Incentives could be awarding additional points in competitive grant programs such as Enhance, Connect Oregon, and Transportation Growth Management, or increasing the amount of state highway revenue apportionment, or increasing the local match requirement for agencies that don't enact a local revenue source, or reduce the interest rate on loans from the Transportation Infrastructure Bank to zero for projects in which local fuel tax revenues are used, or revising the state and federal fund exchange program to dollar for dollar rather than the current 94 cents on the dollar. I believe local governments in Oregon stand ready to work with the legislature in coming up with a new transportation bill. We work through the League of Oregon Cities on the broader topic of transportation funding. I encourage you to provide them with a seat at the table to discuss that issue with them. We're here to help. We're available for questions. I also serve as the chair of the Southwest ACT and will be unable to join you in your meeting in Newport, but we will be well represented there. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may we have a copy of his written testimony?
I can certainly provide it.
Thank you. Where is our person? Right over there.
Right over there. I'll drop it off on the way.
Okay, thank you. Please.
Co-chairs, Senator Beyer and Representative McEwen. My name is Don Gruland. Prior to my retirement 4 years ago, I was Director of Senior and Disability Services for Jackson and Josephine Counties for 35 years. Currently, I am an active AARP volunteer. I am pleased that you are working to create the right statewide transportation for all Oregonians. It is important to recognize that older adults make up a rapidly growing segment of Oregon's population. This is especially true in Southern Oregon. Any comprehensive transportation plan for the future needs to address these needs of older Oregonians. The good news is that a plan that addresses the needs of older Oregonians will also make for a safer, healthier Oregon for all of us. First, pedestrian safety needs to be addressed in any transportation plan. Children, older adults, people of color, and the poor are disproportionately the victims of traffic fatalities while crossing unsafe streets. We need targeted investments in making our streets safer for pedestrians and bicyclists, and should follow the lead of other states and adopt a zero death and injury goal for our streets. Second, we need increased investments in providing transportation options, including special transportation for seniors and people with disabilities. I'm 70 years of age and research indicates that I will likely outlive my ability to drive by 6 years. My wife is likely to outlive her ability to drive by 11 years. Our goal, like 90% of all older Oregonians, is to remain in our home. We recognize, however, that without a more robust public transportation system, that may not be possible. A robust, affordable public transportation system is also critical to those who are unable to afford a car, are unable to drive because of a disability, or simply who wish to cut back on their carbon footprint by using public transportation. Finally, we need to invest in creating more livable communities. Communities that encourage walking, biking, and the using public transportation by making them safe and convenient and affordable alternatives to the automobile. This will require better coordination between transportation and land use planning. Livable communities improve health and cut down on pollution. Thank you for this opportunity to provide input into the transportation needs of Southern Oregon.
Thank you very much.
My name is Jeff Gutting. I don't represent any particular group other than fellow citizens in the area. I live in Jacksonville. I've spent a good part of my career helping other small businesses prosper and survive. And one topic that I heard was going to be discussed here was, and previous gentleman touched on it, was bicycle routes. We have an example. I moved here a few years ago from Las Vegas, where we had quite a bit of bicycle routes in residential areas, not as much in commercial. I've seen the movement in this area in putting in bicycle routes in commercial areas as we have down in Phoenix and Talent now. My significant other is a business owner in both Jacksonville and Ashland, and she drives several days a week to Ashland from Jacksonville going down Highway 99. And in her experience, 4 or 5 days a week, she has yet to see a bicycle rider on these new bicycle routes pass that took out one lane of traffic in Phoenix and Talent. What she has seen is a backup of traffic, a slowing of the traffic flow, and to the detriment of the average citizen who's just trying to get to and from work. The other factor that I think should be mentioned is I have no problem, and I understand that if we say people are using a bicycle as their main form of transportation, that they need to get through commercial areas. But just as we dodged the bullet in Ashland here recently, they were going to take out a whole lane of parking in Ashland right in front of many of these business owners' stores to put in a bicycle lane on both Main Street and Lithia Way. I think sometimes we forget the economic impact of people who are just struggling day to day to get by and what some of these conveniences sometimes how they affect other people. And I'm all for the green thing and helping people and giving people a lane and all that. But the reality is bicycles by law still have the same, can still drive on the streets and highways other than interstates the same way as cars can and have to be provided those privileges. And also we have to look at the practicality of what is the usage actually going to be. Unlike Las Vegas, where most of the terrain is fairly flat and the weather is fairly climate and very little rainfall year-round, we're not in that kind of an environment. I don't know that it's very practical to consider a bicycle as all-weather transportation in this area, and that's a concern. But again, you know, every action has an opposite reaction, and I just want some consideration before we go making some of these major projects and taking out lanes of traffic that are desperately needed for automobiles, that we consider the impact. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
More claps than booze.
Hi. I'm Gary Schaff, and I'll offer a short counterpoint.
Okay.
The Oregon legislature, ODOT, and local governments, despite decades of effort, have yet to succeed in making a multimodal transportation system. It's not surprising. The networks for cycling and walking are incomplete, in poor repair, and don't serve major destinations. Examples include a section of Highway 62 that's 2.1 miles long, that's where the bike lane starts and stops, with the longest segment being no more than a half mile and the shortest being 75 feet. Those don't encourage bicycling. Furthermore, there's sidewalks along Highway 99 in a community of mobile home parks just north of Phoenix where there aren't any. People drive their motorized mobile home or motorized wheelchairs in the travel lane because there's no place else to walk. Largely, residents in this area are poor, elderly, and usually, or sometimes, minorities. And those folks aren't getting a fair share of the transportation dollars in Oregon. Another example of the inadequacy of the transportation system for bicycles, at least, is a 2-foot-wide bike lane that was just recently striped in Medford. Those kinds of facilities, as I've itemized, don't foster cycling nor walking. Portland, at least, viewed from this end of the state, has a well-connected and largely complete bicycle and pedestrian network. There, bicycle commuters account for more than 6% of all work trips. That compares to the dismal statistics in Medford, where bicycle mode share is less than 1%. Funding and construction to complete the urban and metropolitan bicycle and pedestrian system is essential to realize the potential that these modes can achieve. As it is now, most bicyclists or potential bicyclists don't ride. In fact, probably somewhere around 90% of cyclists, according to a study in Portland, don't ride because they perceive the current system of bicycling system, the bicycle system, as unsafe. So how do we correct it, or how can the legislature correct it? You can make those kinds of improvements, pedestrian and bicycle projects, a part of every maintenance project that is funded by ODOT and local government. In that way, the system will eventually, in a reasonably short amount of time, be complete, and the benefits to all Oregonians of having cyclists and pedestrians use those modes rather than an automobile would be realized. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's right. Don Morse, Linny Ellis, and Stuart Foster. To start, please. Welcome.
Thank you. You want me to start first?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I still can't reach it. Okay.
That's
thank you. My name is George Adams. I am the chair of the Oregon State DSAC Board Disabled Services Advisory Committee. I'm also the chair for TransLink and Valley Lift, which is also considered special transportation company.
Thank you.
Special Transportation Board. What I'm here for is to speak for people with disabilities across the whole state of Oregon. We have discovered that all that we're asking for is for the legislature, Senate and House, and including the governor, would consider some type of transportation set up with people with disabilities of all kinds and people that are also seniors. We're discovering that with our independence has been taken away because there's not enough transportation around the state of Oregon, including Astoria, Florence, and amongst other places. Once we've been talking, and all that we're asking is for the legislature to consider giving money to or come up with a plan for cab companies or other companies that could give us the more independence that we can get or that we need to go shopping or to go to medical appointments, because there's not enough transportation for us to go anywhere. And the least transportation there is, then there is a more of a chance of people being depressed along with other things that follows it. I've learned over the years that I had a car accident and it took my independence away because I had to learn a new way on how to live because of my car accident. And so I had to figure out a new way. So with all the disability people we've been talking to around the state, that is what we're requesting for Salem to do, to come up with a plan. There's been research done that Jackson County, along with the state of Oregon, is not prepared for more people with disabilities in the year 2032. It's been on the internet, what the federal government has done a research on. I don't know if you've read it or not, but it's been on the internet for that. So that's what we're having trouble with, and we're hoping that you up there in Salem can help us with that.
Thank you very much.
I'm Don Mars. I'm a resident of Ashland, Oregon, and I'm a member of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Obviously, from our colleagues who have talked over already, transportation infrastructure has been neglected for years and is falling behind. Rail, both freight and passenger, and of course local bus and rail systems, and public bus and rail systems are way behind. But now we are faced with an emergency, dangerously behind the curve, and this emergency is climate change. Okay. Action is needed ASAP. We don't have time, and it can, of course, with all this other stuff accumulated, it's going to be very difficult. Actually, we need to accelerate the replacement of passenger cars and by electric vehicles. We need modernization of long-haul trucks and accelerating rail restoration and improvement. And with all the other things that have fallen behind and are needed, both right and left and all throughout this hearing so far, what do we do? Without the federal government helping, without more awareness of where we are, but we don't have much time because we've got to cut the carbon footprint along with all this others. And many of these issues of local transportation, public transportation, allowing people to get to work and so on without having to drive longer distances or drive at all is an essential part of reducing this carbon footprint. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Lenny Ellis. I'm the business manager of IBEW Local 659 here in Southern Oregon and Northern California. I'd like to thank you all for coming down and listening to our concerns. And I would just like to say that I also am on the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers. We represent about 20,000 electrical workers in the state in utilities and other electrical work contractors. And infrastructure is a big issue for them, getting around to their job sites, trying to bid jobs, especially in the metropolitan areas when the infrastructure isn't there to support the traffic in those areas. And we think that if we could put some money into infrastructure, it would help bolster the economy and also make it easier for our contractors and our members to drive to their job sites. The utility workers travel a lot for their jobs. They don't work in one area. They're all over the place. So we would like to see more infrastructure improvement. And along with that, we would like to see some kind of living wage platforms for the contracts that go out for this infrastructure that support the local economies, local communities, local hire, and those type of things. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Mr. Stewart.
Thank you. My name is Stuart Foster. I am a former member of the Oregon Transportation Commission. I was chair for 4 years. I was on the seismic subcommittee of the Oregon the Governor's Transportation Vision Panel, and I'm chair of TRADCO, which is the Chamber's Transportation Advocacy Committee. We have and I think as you all know, we have a huge threat hanging over us in this region, and it's the Cascadia event. And by the way, it's twice as likely to occur in Southern Oregon and Northern California as it is in the rest of the region, namely Northern Oregon and Washington. Twice as likely to occur here. And when it occurs, because it's going to occur, the lifeline routes to this region, I-5 and Highway 140, will be impassable under current conditions for more than 1 year. ODOT estimates in its Seismic Plus report that if we retrofit all the bridge structures and mitigate landslides in the state of Oregon to address the seismic issue would cost $5 billion, excuse me, and would take decades to implement. We have 300,000 people at risk in Southwest Oregon on the I-5 corridor, Roseburg, Grants Pass, Medford, Ashland, and the other communities. Their lives and livelihoods are at risk. We can't afford to have Harry and David not have access to mobility out of this valley for a year or greater than a year, and the other industries here. We shouldn't be focusing on the viaduct. I've advocated its replacement for years. I've rethought about it. We could have the finest viaduct in the world, and if we have a Cascadia event, it's going to be a bridge to nowhere. So are these bypasses. So is that South Stage overcrossing. I mean, we need to address mobility in and out of this region after a Cascadia event, and we need to do it now. And we can do it for an amazingly modest cost, which can be replicated around the state. Region 3 and ODOT's bridge section are developing a triage approach to the two lifeline routes in this region. The triage approach is simple. Maximize reasonably available detour routes and crossover opportunities, and initially only retrofit bridges and mitigate landslides at choke points. The total estimated cost to triage I-5 south of Highway 58 and Highway 140, Medford to Klamath Falls, would be $35 million. That's the total cost to get I-5 up and running right after a Cascadia event from Eugene to the California border. By the way, we can't depend on California. They don't build their bridges to the same standard as Oregon. That Cascadia event subduction zone goes as far south as Cape Mendocino. 97 ties into I-5 at Weed. We're going to have a disaster in that we aren't going to be able to access California. We need to access east to 97 and Boise and Salt Lake City. We need to provide immediate mobility in and out of the region. For first responders and for freight. Region 3 is fine-tuning this. They're doing it. I mean, this is spectacular work they're doing right now. They're thinking outside of the box, and it really ought to be encouraged, and the legislature needs to implement funding for the triage approach in Region 3. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Gentlemen, the next four people are David Sabia.
Yeah.
I said that wrong. I think it's Sandra Schultz. Willstetter. And is that three or four? That's three. One more. I can't read this one. Matt, can you read that? Well, I guess it's Brad Earle. Brad Earle. Different place. All right. Sorry if I mispronounce your names.
No problem.
Thought you did pretty darn good.
Please.
My name is Sam.
Could you use the microphone, please, so we can get it recorded? That should be fine.
Close enough. You're good.
That's as far as you're going to get.
You're fine.
That'll pick it up.
They're very sensitive. You're fine.
You don't need to get it any closer.
Good.
That's close enough.
Okay. My name is Sandra Schmitz, and I live down by the area by Stage Road where that project is going to be going on, and travel to Phoenix quite often. I'm 72 years young. And I can't walk very well because I have a bad hip. And I can't ride a bicycle because I can't reach the ground unless I have a curb to stop and go.
Thank you.
So that's not an option for me. I also drive many elderly and friends to their doctor's appointments. And I do a lot of volunteer work. So driving a car is the best method for me. I often go drive down the road, and there's bicycles in front of me, and I have to travel 15 miles an hour because they don't make signals or let you know where they're going, and also wheelchairs riding in the middle of the road until I can, you know, get into another lane. And so, you know, and then the freeway off-ramp that's being built. I got lost on that one time and almost on the wrong side of the road and got yelled at, road rage, by someone and said, "You're on the wrong side of the road." And I said, "No kidding, Dick Tracy." And so my husband was an engineer on the space program for North American Rockwell, and he called this type of engineering contemplating your belly button the hard way. So there's a lot more planning that has to be done, and I think that everyone that uses the road, like bicyclers, has to pay some of the costs. They have to get a license, too. So what I want, I don't think legislators or governmental agencies should do anything without the permission of the people who have access to the land, who pay the taxes for the land, and unless the title is determined who owns the property and who has the rights to that property. And so just consider all of these things, please, and that we want that this has to be for the benefit of everyone's health, safety, and welfare. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Al Wilson, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming to the state of Jefferson. I want to make a few brief comments regarding public transportation. Unfortunately, public transportation is usually misconceived. it isn't just the buses you see. Those buses allow fewer parking spaces, allow people to get around, and with an aging population in this area, it is mandatory that we have it. Just take you back historically. I'm a dinosaur. 40 years ago, when we had the energy crunch, and most of you are too young to remember that energy crunch in the 70s. Rogue Valley Transit was born of necessity. Number one, we had an air pollution problem, plus no transportation. We started with two leased buses. And fortunately, 40 years later, it's up and running with 40 buses covering 7 municipalities in Southern Oregon. I think basically what should be addressed is consistent funding. These temporary grants and varying temporary infusions do not lead for constant public transportation. I think, number one, Rogue Transit is actually an extension of the bicycle path. And looking at multimodal, I think some of the bicycle money would well be put into the coffers of Rogue Valley Transit, because they are essentially an extension of the bicycle path. They have the racks and everything else. Other than that, thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you very much.
Good evening, and thank you for coming. My name is Brad Earl. I'm the Chief Operations Officer at the Medford School District. So I'm here to talk about actually three things, schools, why I'm here for schools. Secondly, as an employer, and then third, kind of a little bit for myself. So we're the eighth largest school district in the state of Oregon. We're the seventh largest employer in Jackson County, so that gives you an idea of who we are. We just recently collaborated with the Rogue Valley Transit District to have a transit district bus that runs from South Medford High School, crossing Central Medford High School to North Medford High School, and heading out to the White City campus of Rogue Community College. I think you all know that the 7:30 to 3:30 Monday through Friday model of education just doesn't work for most kids anymore. So we're looking for alternatives to help kids launch into our communities and colleges and universities, and that partnership and collaboration is one of the things that we're very excited about. We would love to see more of that. I'm often curious about whether there's an eventual potential opportunity to tap into some of the federal funds that we have available to us for transportation of students in yellow buses to start to augment those sort of things. But that doesn't exist today, so we'll be putting pressure on our students and families and even on our own system to compensate kids to go out to those campuses. But we're pretty excited about it. We think it gives kids some great opportunities. The other issue that we have is walking students. You know, we have students at elementary schools that walk if they're a mile away from the school, mile and a half if it's a secondary school. I'm one of the people at the school district that goes out and walks myself on some of the ones that the routes that people call me and say it's just not safe for my kid to be on that route. And some of them, that's the truth. They're not very safe. We make exceptions where we can, but our federal funding is limited in making those exceptions, so we're very careful about making those exceptions. But walking infrastructure is something that we need to continue to focus on in Southern Oregon. We have way too many helicopter parents, and absent safe walking routes, what they do is drive their kids. And you can imagine what some of our elementary schools look like in the morning. We actually have traffic police effectively that show up at some of our schools and help parents come in and out of the parking lots. And we actually have a valet at one of our schools that calls up the next car, and then the kid gets in it. It's crazy. And we even have the sheriffs that have to show up at one of our school periodically to manage traffic. So that's not a good situation. So finally, just talking as an employer, as we look at building new schools, one of the things I look at is how much is it going to cost for me to build parking. And that's not the thing I like to look at. I like to build schools that are exciting for education and not exciting for people to park at. Finally, for myself, I'm a longtime cyclist, and I'll just tell a quick story. I raced competitively for 30 years. I raced in packs of cyclists of about 90, screaming along at 30 miles an hour. And I'll do that every day over praying Frogger on Highway 99 with the cars.
Thank you.
My name is David Sabia. I live here in Jackson County. Thank you to our chair, our co-chair, and all you panelists for coming out here tonight. Thank you very much. I'd like to address what's been going on around here with the scuttlebutt on Highway 99 and the road diet. I'm, as a cyclist, I'm one of those crazy people that does ride year-round. I'm out there in the rain and snow, and 3 o'clock in the morning, some people see me out there between Phoenix and Talent. So I'm against having the single lane with two gentlemen explained it to me. It's called a twiddle. It's the center dividing lane that you pull into, and you can sit there and wait to get in the traffic. It's a usually orange and striped space because you can cut across a couple lanes from a business because you're trying to make either a left or right-hand turn, and you can't get – I mean a left-hand turn, and you can't get over. So my concept is a modified road diet. Two lanes as now stands – with a, it's called an extra wide twiddle of 16 feet, extra wide lanes. So if lanes are 12, make them 14 because of trailers, mobile home hauling, and that sort of thing. And 8-foot bike paths and extra wide sidewalks. And how could that be done on a road that has businesses built right up to the edge? Well, this is where cooperation between Jackson County, private landowners in the rural areas, businesses, and municipalities comes in, and we all work together to get Pacific Power to put their power poles in ground. If those poles weren't there, some of the people that we're talking about where people come out on their wheelchairs and they can't use the sidewalk, if anybody has driven between Medford and Phoenix, you know that there's power poles right there in places that might be, or even if there is a sidewalk, it's right in the middle of the sidewalk, and you can only have maybe a 2-foot or 18-inch sidewalk. I know I can show many places where that exists. So I'm a fan of the road diet, but I'm not a fan of going to single lane each way. Primarily, as a bicyclist, it wouldn't bother me. But I'm looking at people who are following the proverbial school bus. And anybody who's ever been trapped behind a school bus knows that there's no rule for them to pull over and let the 500 cars behind them go on about their business. And with two lanes, maybe you have a chance to get around and escape. Otherwise, you're going to have 1,000 cars following a school bus from Medford to Talent, and that's ridiculous. So I'm proposing a modified road diet. What the city of Phoenix has done, I think, is commendable. It's tough for some people. I appreciate the concerns I've heard. Anyways, thank you all very much, and I hope that can be considered. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming out tonight. All right, the next four, and I'm going to apologize in advance because I'm sure I'm going to get this name wrong. It looks like Gunnar Archambault or Archambault, Bill Meyer, Louise Shawkat, and I think it's Michael Shaw.
Louise Shawkat. First of all, we should not have to choose between repair of crumbling infrastructure and reduction of greenhouse gases, which address climate change and public health. How would I like public tax dollars spent to improve the state's transportation system? Investing in advanced transportation technologies that address climate change and protect public health. About one-third of Oregon's total global warming emissions come from the transportation sector. We can cut these harmful emissions by supporting the following technologies: electrifying passenger cars, More electric vehicles, EVs, in Oregon would produce fewer global warming emissions than any gasoline-powered vehicle on the road. With Oregonians continuing to transition to cleaner sources of electricity, the climate advantages of EVs will only increase. Also, as a bicycle rider, electric bikes are in fashion. To remind you, fueling with electricity is cheaper than gasoline. Drivers save money that can be spent in economic sectors that create local jobs. Electricity prices are also remarkably stable compared with gasoline. True, EVs have a higher sticker price, but the total cost of owning an EV can be lower than owning a conventional gasoline vehicle. EVs still face barriers to their operation, so we need policies that will make EVs available and affordable for more Oregonians. I would like the legislature to consider the following measures to encourage EVs. Rebates for the purchase of lease of zero-emission and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. Two, targeted programs for low-income, disadvantaged, and rural populations. In addition, Oregon must modernize its freight system to provide cleaner air, a safer climate, and improved health for all of its communities. A clean, modern freight system will rely on deployment of advanced zero-emission technologies, as well as smarter conventionally powered trucks that are far more fuel efficient and less polluting than those on the road today. I would like the legislature and this body to consider the following measures to help create a cleaner freight system. One, incentives for commercialized hybrid and electric trucks and transit buses. And two, demonstration projects for zero emission dryage trucks and port equipment. And finally, help fleets retrofit or replace highly polluting diesel trucks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. We're going to take a mic check for a moment. Can everyone in the room hear okay?
Yes.
And you guys can all hear okay. Okay. It's a good thing to check periodically.
Thank you for that.
My name is Glenn Archambault. I'm a business owner and a landowner in the Phoenix area. And I'm going to spend a moment here, and we're going to review the city of Phoenix and the current road project that is yet to be finished. I was there in 2004 when ODOT and USDOT, Jackson County, arrived and started explaining to us business owners what needed to be done. The first step was they made sure that if we didn't agree, they would just simply condemn our properties, which they proceeded to do so. This is an important point because we're going to build more road systems, but we need to go back to that town and listen to what the business and landowners have to say about how this project has gone. It has not gone well for us. My family's business after 25 years is out of business, as many others are, and many more will come. And many are doing poorly. And I've personally walked up and down the roads there and asked people very pointed questions. And quietly, off by themselves, they'll tell you how things are going. Going to restaurants, they have one client for lunch. Why did that happen? I don't think anybody knows completely why it happened, but it's a question that needs to get answered. We need to go back. I'll work with you folks. I'll work with whoever you want to appoint. We need to go back and really listen to these people because we're going to confront this issue over and over. How many of you ever had your home or land condemned? My family's had it done 5 times to us. We had 2 condemnation processes going at the same time in 2004. It's a hard life to live. So I've taken it on myself to investigate this, listen to people, but I think you folks have to do that too because we can't keep going to communities and saying it's our way or the highway. That's not working. That might have worked well 100 years ago when the railroad came through, but this is not the railroad. We need a system and we need an arrangement that works well for all these people. I hope some of you folks took the time to go and visit Phoenix and try to drive the roads, go into the truck stop. Critical aspect of that area. Harry and David is there. We lost many of our businesses. Our big ones, Associated Fruit, failed. We've got real economic problems, and I don't want to see that visited on other communities. So I want you guys to really remember this. This is really important, because if we don't resolve this, people like me are going to go to the other communities, and we're going to explain to them what legally happened to all of us. And that's going to set off a firestorm in this state. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bill Meyer, live in Medford. I question the policies in the slanted vision process, which has brought us here through the state's roadmap to 2020, Vision 2050, adopted by the state policy, adopted by State Environmental Commission, I should add. It has now oozed its way into faulty transportation policy. Policy isn't law. Your legislative policy of adhering and taking an environmental stance in our transportation issues in Southern Oregon is illegitimate. I don't wish the state pursuing environmentalism in transportation choices as a byproduct of implementing sustainable development policy. Thousand Friends of Oregon do not speak for me, but they have undue influence in determining policy, as do the other green consensus groups. This is a legislative information gathering meeting, but I would say that any use of the policy consensus stakeholder input process here, if used, is fraudulent. This isn't a dispute resolution. The input required by the law of the state of Oregon is to be that of the people. I demand that we get actual statements of users of the road and not the fraudulent voices, as I see them, of manufactured stakeholder consensus groups from outside our area. This transportation system is a matter of county concern. That's where the emphasis should be placed. The vast majority of Jackson County's real road users demand safe, efficient transportation systems and roads. And when I say roads, I mean useful roads. We're not demanding road diets. We're not asking for bicycle paths on Highway 99 built at the expense of actually useful automotive and truck commerce capable roads. And let me explain that this bike path, while I'm feeling good about it and underutilized, I might add, is a clear and present danger against your constitutionally mandated concern for the health, safety, and welfare of the citizens. On one hand, the legislative transportation policy wants us prepared for the big one, the cataclysmic seismic event. And on the other hand, faulty transportation policy encourages the actual reduction of road capacity needed in such an emergency. I would add that we are not demanding Orego or other citizen travel tracking, tagging, bagging, and taxing schemes born from the sustainable development addled technocrats in the legislature and the administration. Nor are we demanding a carbon tax, which would be yet another intolerable financial rape of what's left of Southern Oregon's productive sector. It's been largely kicked to the curb by Oregon legislature's embrace of this false god, sustainable development. What we are demanding, the full use of these granted roads for peaceful travel and commerce. Stop this insane state policy of implementing voluntary executive orders of sustainable development. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's all over your state documents. Interim roadmap of 2020 as an example. The 2050 goal, reducing carbon at least 75% below 1990 levels and build a prosperous, clean, energy-based 21st century state economy. It's a preposterous roadmap to economic ruin. This is not what the road users in Jackson County wish. We demand the unencumbered use of these granted roads, folks. In conclusion, I demand you cease any plans, legislative or administrative, for implementing carbon taxes, low carbon fuel standards, mileage tracking and taxing, road diets, other further implementation of sustainable development. These are not ODOT roads. They're not stakeholder roads. They're the people's roads. You need money. I get it. Raise the gas. I'm going to throw up in my mouth a little bit. Raise the gas tax if you must. It is at least anonymous and not subject to green social engineering. Cease this illegitimate policy of pushing the people off their roads and pushing them off their actual preferred and effective modes of transportation. Thank you.
My name is Michael Shaw. I'm not going to be as elegant as Bill has been.
He wasn't.
I'm here representing no one but myself. I'm a small business owner. I'm the CEO, founder of Shaw Asset Management, Premier Packaging and Shipping, Premier Delivery Service, and Premier Logistics. I've heard a lot of people talk about wanting bike paths, buses, cabs, anything and everything that has to do with personal transportation. Yes, it's a big concern for a lot of people. The reality is those people speaking on that behalf aren't considering the commercial use of our roads. There is no viable electric vehicle for use in our commercial environment. It just doesn't exist. It may not exist for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. The cost of me doing business, because I'm a transportation-oriented business, has risen every year for the 15 years I've been in this valley. It's gotten to the point where I probably will not exist as a business 2 years from now if you keep raising the rates. I understand, Bill, you know, and the gas tax and such, that hits us. All those costs that you keep adding on to the business people in this area has led to many, many businesses going out of business in this community. We are almost what you would consider a failed area. We have medical, we have tourism, and a few other large companies. The small business owners are all suffering. And if the elected officials keep down the path that they're on right now, you may survive in Portland. You may even survive in Eugene. You will not survive in Medford. This will become a ghetto area. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Ladies. Atkinson, Morgan Beckhold, I think, R.M. Fink, and Ellen Triplett.
Thank you. My name is Michelle Blum Atkinson. I live in Medford. Thank you, members of the committee, for having us here today. I am actually lucky to be sitting here today to tell you my story of how I almost died. And that was when I was walking to school when I was 6 years old and was hit by a Jeep. Spent the next 6 weeks in the hospital. And luckily, I have fully recovered. But since then, it has become something very important to me. I now live here in Medford near Hoover Elementary, and there are no sidewalks going from my house to where my two girls are going to go to school. And that worries me. I see them having to walk around a blind corner, and I want to make sure they're safe. So, you know, when I think of transportation, I think of the human element of it. And there, I know it's a very complicated issue, but this is something that I would like to work towards. I'm actually running for Medford City Council to help find solutions to this problem. And I'm not here to say that the government needs to pay for this. It's all the government's responsibility. I think as a homeowner, I have a responsibility to make sure that the paths to schools are safe. Another thing, my other perspective here is as a business owner, I'm part owner or was part owner of ProCare Software, a company here in Medford with over 50 employees. And so I think business has a lot of opportunity to help the transportation solutions as well. So we have companies such as Uber. We have companies such as Tesla. We have a company called Mobileye, who a lot of buses are using to, it actually has a camera and a sensor, and it will alert a bus driver if there's a pedestrian walking in front of the bus. So there are a lot of advanced technologies that I think we could explore that could really save lives. And so I encourage you look at these technologies, and if you have any questions, I would be more than willing to help advise on any technology policy here in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Can you hear me okay?
Okay.
Hello all, my name is Morgan Bechtold. I'm a student from Southern Oregon University. So I've lived in the Valley my entire life. As a child, I grew up on a farm that was so far out in the boonies, it was 45 minutes just to get to the outskirt of town. Not long after moving into town, I realized everything was different, that the air no longer smelled like forest, it now reeked of exhaust. And I remember thinking that this was, wow, this is the big city. And we were just in Medford. So now having traveled and getting to know what a real big city is, I can look back on my childhood memory and think Medford or the Valley may not be a real big city, but we do have real transportation problems. I commute every day from Medford to Ashland to get to school. Most of the time I take I-5, but I would prefer to take the bus. As I'm sure you know, the majority of people that take the bus are elderly, low-income families, people of color, and people with disabilities. Now, while I might not fall into any of those categories, I would still prefer to take the bus. But sometimes the congestion gets so bad on I-5 that I'd rather not ruin my day by driving and let a trained professional take the wheel. The bus can be fun. Instead of stressing over road rage, I can sit back and do my homework during my commute. And ultimately, I would want to be a part of the solution by adding one more person who supports public transit rather than adding another car on the road. So with all that being said, why don't I just take the bus? Why do I drive? Well, I'm not a morning person. And I often stay up late studying, just like most students do. I need all the sleep I can get. That being said, it takes me 30 minutes to get from my driveway to anywhere I need to be on campus when I drive my own vehicle. Whereas when I take the bus, it's an hour and a half. That's an hour of sleep that I'm missing. Yes, that matters. And now, also, as a very involved student on campus, my schedule varies from day to day, often hour to hour. Sometimes I'm home by 5 o'clock, other nights I'm home by midnight. That being said, the bus isn't running after that, and if I have taken the bus in the morning and then find out that the bus is gone, then my husband has to come and pick me up, and that's not a happy day. So to avoid that, I just end up driving. So my situation is not uncommon among many students who commute to Ashland every day. Our school is a commuter school, and some live even farther, as far as Grants Pass or Eureka. In my opinion, what our valley needs is a improved transit system. The congestion is intolerable, and not just on the interstate, but throughout town. By improving that, we'll have less grumpy people on the road, less road rage, faster trips with more routes and more buses running on said routes, less accidents, and ultimately be more economical and more environmentally friendly. So these are all examples that I would hope that you consider when making decisions on funding with our transportation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Tom Fink. I'm a relatively recent immigrant to Southern Oregon. And I come to you today with a cautionary tale. I listen to Jefferson Public Radio off and on all day. One of the things I noticed is that there are very frequent weather reports. You all hear the Northern California coast, the Southern Oregon coast, the Umpqua Basin, the Klamath Basin, it goes on, and they do this several times a day. Where I'm from, they do not report on the weather. They report on traffic. So where I'm from is actually Silicon Valley, and that was once an agricultural community, and I watched I grew up there, lived there 60 years, watched it being transformed from an agricultural community with a centralized business district to one of sprawl, and sprawl and freeways, which leapfrogged over each other. Every time a freeway was put forward to solve a traffic congestion problem, it would only generate more sprawl and more traffic. So I tell this tale because I actually drove a transit bus down in San Jose for 25 years, and I'm acutely attuned to traffic patterns. And I can see developing here what really ruined the Santa Clara Valley. And I've watched the final stages of the construction of the Phoenix Interchange. It's a real work of freeway art, I have to say. It's an elegant piece of concrete. But I wonder, it was designed, and I've been to the ODOT office there in the shopping center right off the road, and they explained that it's designed to solve the bottleneck problem on that road. And my question to you is, how much thought has gone in, what the consequences will be of such an efficient, a highly efficient, high-capacity freeway interchange on development, especially to the east of Phoenix? That land all appears to be prime development land. One of the lessons we learned too late, really, in Santa Clara Valley was that transportation and land use are inextricably linked. And people are paying attention to that now and doing a fairly good job of it. New train systems are coming in, building high-rise, mixed-use, very dense residential development. It's called transit-oriented development. And I've seen the traffic nodes since I've been here for only the last year and a half, but I have seen them getting worse. And so I suggest to you that we look way down the road and really begin to very seriously integrate transportation and land use. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is Mike Montero. I appreciate your being here and the opportunity to speak before you. I have been listening to the testimony, and what strikes me is that virtually all of the testimony, I think at the end of the day, if we were asked personally, if we agreed that these are the needs, we'd all agree they are. This is a funding crisis. But for the constrained funding source that we have available to maintain the ditches, to provide for transit and the like, we would all be in a very different meeting. We'd be sitting down trying to figure out how to make these things work together. And I will tell you, having said on many ODOT committees, they do a marvelous job with what they have. Now, that having been said, I am very concerned, and I think that Stuart Foster spoke eloquently about the risk to the valley, and I'm here to represent the interests of freight. And I want to have everybody in this room think about what life would be if all freight deliveries into this valley stopped for 6 months. And I don't care if you ride a bicycle, you depend on transit, you ride a car, when there's no more food, no more toilet paper, and everything else, we've got a big problem. And if that lasts for a period of time, we have a crisis. And we don't know when the Cascadia subduction will occur. It may not happen in our lifetime. But I would offer, can we afford to be wrong? And if we're wrong, then there are going to be consequences. And I would argue that's what we need to think about. But it doesn't have to be an either-or. I will just make reference to an ODOT planning process called the Transportation Options Topic Plan. And we had participation there from the bicycle community, the pedestrian community, and of all people, the freight community. And what they came to a conclusion about is that personal transportation can be provided by a whole array of options. Freight has few. We rely on airports, ports, railroads, and trucks. And about 80% of it comes in a truck. Now, do I know what the transportation future is going to look like 20 years from now? I don't. I don't know what the fuel sources are going to look like. I don't know if they're going to be driverless. But I can tell you this, that based on the analysis that's been done for the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee, freight movements through Oregon, and those are coastal freight movements, are contemplated to go up by about 40% in the next 20 years. Anybody that drives an I-5 right now knows what the freight movements are. So strategic investments in off-system that can preserve that capacity for freight modes that don't have any options can be strategic and smart. So that means investments into transit, investments into trails, investments into bicycle facilities, where measurable reductions to the dependency on these precious freight routes can be smart planning. So we appreciate you being here and giving us the opportunity to afford you our comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you all. Our next four are Deb Evans, Helga Motley, Ronald Sandifer, I think, and let's see, Shirley Anderson. Missing one, but okay. Welcome. Please start.
I'm Helga Motley. I live in Talent now. I am a lifelong, avid, non-car preferred person and use bicycles a lot. I am quite willing and able, even at age 74, to use my bike winter, summer, no matter what the weather. I have trailers. And I don't really need a lot of bike lanes because if the traffic is slow enough, I can maneuver around and stay on the side. But there are places where crossing main roads like the 99 from Talent Avenue is quite the challenge because there's traffic coming constantly from the cars. So that kind of passing over busy roads is an important aspect. I would love to see more bus service more frequently and at all hours so that people who work in our service industry into late at night and students and can have access to the bus service. I would even suggest that smaller buses that go little short routes would be a good option because you see these huge buses with almost no one on them. I know that requires an investment in a different kind of bus, but you know we have to think about other options. And I have bought an electric assist bike 14 months ago, and I've already put 2,000 miles on it.
Thank you.
My name is Ronald Sandifer. I am a Medford resident. I live three blocks from here. And thank goodness, because I don't have a car. And I just want to subjectively say that I am very pro-transit, very pro-green. And it's not fascism, as some may advocate, because I'm anti-fascism. And I'm also believing in global warming because most scientists agree with that, and I support, I'm a pedestrian, I don't have a bike, I don't have a car, so it's the buses, I support them, they're getting better, and I'm thumbs up. I just like to advocate all of Oregon to be like that, and we have to take care of this, and I have a selfish reason, I want clean air because I have asthma, so I'm a man of few words, and I get to the point, and that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Deb Evans. I'm a parent, a gardener, a timber owner, and co-founder of Hair on Fire Oregon. Thank you all so much for being here. We really appreciate you coming to Southern Oregon. Sometimes we have to travel up to Salem to be heard, and we love it when you're here and close by. I support many of the excellent points that have been made this evening, but my concern and the overarching concern that trumps, I think, a lot of these objections is an even larger challenge that we cannot ignore, and that is climate change. I believe that the charge of this joint committee must be to ensure that every directive you put forward results in the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions from transportation sector and that it aligns with the best science to preserve Oregon, the Oregon that we know and love for future generations. On Jefferson Public Radio this week, I heard Senator Beyer speak about some of the issues that others around the state have brought up: congestion through Portland, the need to ensure that Oregon products can get to market so that our economy does not falter, and others have echoed that here tonight. As a timber owner and manager, I am far more concerned whether we in here in Southern Oregon are going to have any products to sell if we continue business as usual and don't address the real threat of climate change that we are facing. Extreme weather events here, drought, lowered snowpack, increased wildfires all directly impact industries here, including agriculture, fisheries, wineries, tourism, and all predicted in the Climate Trust 2014 report to the legislature. All told, these impacts will catastrophically affect industry, and these industries that I've mentioned account for $46 billion of income annually in the state of Oregon. According to the Climate Trust report, doing business as usual will cost us between 5% and 20% GDP worldwide, while being proactive and reducing greenhouse gas emissions will cost 1% GDP. Transportation accounts for 39% of Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions. It is imperative that we drastically lower these numbers as quickly as possible. Despite Oregon's aspirational goals set in 2007, the wedge between where we are currently at roughly 61 million tons per year of greenhouse gas pollution and where science says we need to be to stay under the Paris Climate Agreement of 1.5 degrees Celsius, we need to be at about 4 million tons per year by 2050, and that's an 8% reduction per year between 2018 and 2050. Now, these are huge lifts. We all understand that. We understand that it's not going to be easy to get there. I get that we need freight. I live up on the Green Springs. I live, you know, that's 16 miles out of Ashland. We know if the Cascadia subduction zone comes, we're toast, right? We're not getting to Ashland. So our community is starting to prepare for that and think about the things that we can do. So I have ideas. I've submitted written testimony of how we can get there. I won't take any more time except to say there is one video that I would highly encourage everybody to watch. And it's from the Netherlands. It's about a biking community where 60% of the transport is bicycles. I'm not saying Oregon is going to transfer instantly to something like that, but I think they have solutions worldwide that we need to be looking at, and I encourage you to think outside of the box and not just continue business as usual. Thank you.
Thank you. The next four are Lana Fassett, Ellen Jornet, Dan Davis, and Greg Holmes.
I'm sorry, which order are we in? Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Whoever wants to start. We'll just start.
My name is Alan Journey. I'm co-facilitator of Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. Thank you all for traveling the state and giving residents the opportunity to contribute to Oregon's transportation policy. We appreciate it very much. I speak specifically on behalf of the 1,000 or so Southern Oregonians who are Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, and more generally on behalf of the children of Oregon, the millions of children across the planet now, and the innumerable millions of as yet unborn. The science tells us clearly and unequivocally that the greatest threat facing humanity is that posed by global warming and its climate change consequences. Those paying attention to the science and the trends we see around us realize that to say that climate change poses a threat to all life on the planet, though it sounds alarming, is accurate. Fortunately for us, the evidence suggests that these trends are human-induced and thus reversible. The cause is emissions of greenhouse gases from human activity. These emissions result from largely from our burning fossil fuels, but also from our agriculture, forestry, and land management activities. The data tell us that transportation accounts for nearly 40% of the annual emissions of these gases in Oregon. If we wish to assume our moral responsibility to contribute to addressing this problem, we should pay attention to the emissions that result from transportation and reduce them whenever possible. To this end, I specifically ask that Oregon transportation policy, I'm apologizing for reiterating the points already made, one, encourage plug-in hybrid and fully electric vehicles wherever possible, particularly though through rebates for the purchase or lease of such vehicles, and through programs that target low-income, disadvantaged, and rural populations, making electrical vehicles more accessible. Two, develop incentives that promote commercial hybrid and electric vehicles, promote zero emissions short-haul vehicles, promote zero emissions port vehicles and equipment, and encourage the retrofit and replacement of highly polluting diesel vehicles. Three, recognize that public transit is more than a convenience that should be financially self-supporting. It is a valuable public service that both transports residents and reduces greenhouse gas emissions. Thus, it deserves funding support not only in major urban but also in rural and small urban communities, and it deserves support in promoting student transportation options. Rather than simply devote funds to construction of new and wider roads, I urge that funds be devoted first and foremost to repairing and refurbishing the dilapidated and outdated infrastructure of roads and bridges that blight our state. Lastly, but most importantly, Oregon transportation policy should acknowledge that the state of Oregon has greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals and that transportation is a major contributor to these emissions and thus we should take the lead in reducing emissions wherever possible. Transportation policy considerations should assign a high priority to how any proposals increase or decrease greenhouse gas emissions. We should favor those doing the latter, decreasing emissions, rather than those doing the former, increasing emissions. Transportation policy, while important, should not compromise our ability to meet the greenhouse gas emissions reductions goals established by the Oregon Legislature in 2007. Thank you for your time and attention, and special thanks to those of you working to reduce our state greenhouse gas emissions.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Greg Holmes. I live in Grants Pass, Oregon. For the last 14 years, I've been the Southern Oregon advocate for 1,000 Friends of Oregon, working in the Rogue Valley, among other places. We have some interesting challenges. In the course of that work, I've done a lot of work with the MPOs and RVTD. We have a lot of challenges here, including we're one of the faster pot growing areas in the state. We have a significantly higher percentage of retirees than some other portions of the state, and those provide with some unique challenges for us here. We started right off the bat with Mr. Weil talking about the maintenance issues, and we've been hearing this for quite a while, and you've heard it from all over the state, I'm sure, that communities all over the state are having trouble keeping up paying the cost of the maintenance for the facilities that we already have. Focusing on building additional facilities is only going to exacerbate that problem by creating more when we don't even have the funding sources to maintain what we've got. We've heard a couple pleas tonight for building new facilities to increase our capacity both for freight and for mobility for individuals within the region. Another far less expensive way to create some of that capacity is to increase the efficiency of the facilities that we already have in place today. We can achieve that by creating a truly balanced multimodal system of transportation, which we do not have. Make no mistake, we do not have that, especially in this portion of the state. That includes better funding of transit, cycling, and pedestrian facilities, and connecting those facilities together. I'm an avid cyclist. I'll ride my bike just about anywhere. I've ridden on interstates. I've ridden on 99. I'm kind of crazy that way, but a lot of people won't do that. But if we give people choices, real choices, where they feel safe operating a bicycle or walking or using transit with connectivity to the places they need to be and the places they need to go. Some people, not everybody, not even a majority probably, but some people will get out of their cars if they have the choice to get out of their cars. By getting those people out of their cars, we need less road miles, we need less parking spaces, and we need to build fewer facilities and thus decrease our maintenance costs. Now, if you want to know what the people of the Rogue Valley want in a transportation system, I'm surprised nobody's mentioned this before. You need to look no further than earlier this year when the voters of the Rogue Valley voted to assess themselves additional taxes to increase funding for RVTD here. In order to reestablish Saturday service, which had been cut, we still don't have Sunday service, and to increase local services, daily service routes. That is clearly something that the voters of the people of the Rogue Valley want. I'd just like to end by saying, don't look backwards in coming up with the whatever policies and funding packages you come up with in this process. Look forward. Create a system that is truly balanced and gives people real choice, and we will help to solve some of our problems here in a much less expensive way. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Dan Davis. I live in Talent. 12-year resident of Southern Oregon from upstate New York. I'm currently a member of the board of directors for RVTD, and when I was in New York, I worked for GE and started and ran my own businesses there. And I have to say I'm so impressed with RVTD and the management and staff of that organization. So one thing to keep in mind when you're considering funding for rural transit districts is that I'm sure that the other districts are well managed as well, but I can speak for RVTD. I like pavement, but I also like the fact that there are ways to reduce our need for using vehicles that burn a lot of fuel and contribute to global warming, and that's one of the issues. One of the reasons I'm gladly serving on the board is to do what I can to improve transit and help that along, which will also help the major problem we have with climate change. Funding support, I always wondered why Oregon has essentially no diesel tax. California has a diesel tax and Washington has a diesel tax. And Oregon has a reduction of about 40 cents a gallon, I think. It's been several years since I looked at that, so that might be a little bit out of date. But certainly trucks do use a lot of wear and tear, cause a lot of wear and tear on our roads. And so that's something maybe the committee should be looking at. I realize that trucks and commercial transportation are really important for us, but we also need to maintain our roads. And by the way, I have to say that based on my experience in other states, Oregon has awesome roads, and I think ODOT is to be congratulated for the job that they do on maintaining and repairing roads. The other thing about New York that I really liked, although I'm living in paradise now compared to New York, was the rail transit systems. When I lived in near Albany, and when I needed to go to New York City or D.C., my preferred method was to take the train, and it was just awesome. It was beautiful training down along the Hudson and sitting there and work reading the paper or doing my work. And I'd like to see Oregon is such a forward-thinking state and always has been. I would really like to see us begin planning for more rail transit for people from Southern Oregon up to at least to Eugene. I know there's rail from Eugene to Portland, I believe, but we need to start thinking about that. And I know it's a big deal. It's a lot of money, and we need to start working on that. And these are important things. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Hello. I'm a 72-year-old.
Could I get you to put your name on the record, please?
Pardon me?
Your name, please.
Oh, the name is Lana Fawcett, F-A-W-C-E-T-T. I'm a real stakeholder here. I decided I can no longer remain silent in spite of my paralyzed vocal cord, which makes me sound weird. Thank you very much for coming down to listen to our concerns. I've been a rural Westerner almost my entire life, with the exception of 40 years living in the Silicon Valley. So I have a perspective of various sides. I grew up in rural Northern California earthquake country. We had earthquakes on a regular basis. I am a retired school superintendent, before that principal, before that teacher, a lot in the special education area, so I have a perspective on that also. I'm very concerned about, as we all are, about the lives that we're living, but I'm primarily becoming increasingly more concerned about the loss of freedom. I'm not representing an environmental group with an agenda promoted by the United Nations. I didn't come from a huge city area, so I recognize there are differences between the wonderful urban area of Portland compared to rural Oregon. We are not used to bus, to train systems and bus systems, and with a large integrated system, you should have choices. But you shouldn't be caused to lose your anonymity nor your personal freedom. One of the reasons that our whole country has done well economically is we have the freedom to make choices and do differences. I have nothing against RVTD. However, I do see a lot of buses riding around empty. I have nothing against bicyclists. I'm not a bicyclist. However, before they instituted the road diet on Highway 99, and I can editorialize more than that, but I don't want to run out of time. My husband and I took shifts for a week counting the number of bicyclists on Highway 99. There were virtually, if we saw seven in a day, it was a miracle. So if you are riding your bicycle, or if you were at the time, it would have been helpful if you would have waved at us. Let's see. I had a couple of I guess I like options for everyone, and I sense we're closing these options down increasingly. And a couple of things came to mind. Security regarding the earthquakes. I'm appalled at the idea of the road diet on 99 that closes off. If you're really concerned about safety, when something happens to I-5, which is our other main artery, and particularly, and also for those of us on the western side of I-5, 99 was our mode of transportation, of connection north and south. North and south. However, now, courtesy of the road diet, when they have a problem on I-5, everyone's funneled down into 99, and it's a real traffic jam. I keep remaking my notes as I went around. There were so many interesting topics. Oh, the other thing, I'm obviously not using this mic correctly. I think that it seems to me that I wonder about, you know, we love cities, counties, we all love to have money, but are all of the hidden ties and the obligations concerned with this money truly being exposed? I have to tell you, I did not plan weeks or months or days, obviously, for this presentation, but I thought I, as a real citizen, do want to express my voice. The other thing is I'm concerned about, we're trying to encourage business in Southern Oregon, so what do? We make it more difficult for...
Can I ask you to sum up, please?
Oh, yes. Okay. In summation, I'm concerned about the prioritization of spending, the true obligations that we would incur by accepting money, and then also the loss of our personal freedoms. That means anonymity to travel, and it does not mean necessarily taking a bus, although if I wanted to take a bus, I could.
Thank you
very much for putting up with this terrible voice. Maybe it will be fixed in the next several weeks. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, next for, I think it's Robert Crawley, Sarah Westover, Lucerne, Costana, and Hannah Stoll.
Well, my name is Sarah Westover. I live here in Phoenix, Oregon. And I'm also a board member for Rogue Climate here, which is a nonprofit, a youth-led nonprofit that is focused on practical solutions to climate change. I also volunteered with Rogue Valley Transit Now to help restore funding to the Rogue Valley Transportation District so our buses could run. I am also a person who lives with epilepsy and can no longer drive. And when I lost my license to drive, it was a major blow to my autonomy, my personal autonomy, because we don't have the best public transportation systems in place for people like me, people with disabilities, young people, elderly folks, people who otherwise can't drive to get around, and that's a problem. So in the Rogue Valley, it's particularly challenging when you live in more of a rural area. When I lived up in Portland, it was a little bit easier to get around, and it's, you know, not that I'm expecting that in the Rogue Valley us to have a transportation system like TriMet, although that would be cool. But it's really important for us to have a stable source of public funding and for it to be a top priority, both at the state and local levels, to invest in our public transportation systems and in our public infrastructure. The roads belong to all of us, not just to cars. You know, for folks who, a lot of people have been talking about Phoenix, which is where I live. There's a road diet, there's the interchange, it's, The road diet, though, I do want to say that making our streets more walkable should be a top priority. As a relatively younger person, I still want to live on this planet for, you know, whatever time I've got left, and I want clean, breathable air. And we know that in Oregon and throughout the nation, one of the top sources of climate pollution and just of air pollution that harms, is detrimental to people's health, comes from personal vehicles. And obviously, you know, I don't think it's time to transition personal vehicles out completely at this juncture, but we have to start thinking ahead. We have to start making innovations so that we are curbing significantly our climate emissions so that people like me, generations that come after me, have a safe and livable climate to live in. This is should be priority number one for our state legislature, is addressing our climate pollution in the state of Oregon. And public transportation provides us some avenues to do that. You know, and there's also the social issues that are attached to transportation. The working people rely on public transportation, students, younger people. These are some of our communities, or elderly populations, some of our communities most vulnerable, and we need to be looking out for them because, after all, that's what community is all about. So thank you for coming down here and listening to us today and hearing our priorities.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Hannah Soule, and I live in Talent. It's really great to see so many people here engaging in this public process, and folks, it's just really amazing to see how many people are coming out today to talk about transportation, and I think that really shows how important this issue is to our community. So I grew up here in Southern Oregon, and for a while I lived in Phoenix, and it is a cluster in Phoenix right now when it comes to transportation. And a lot of the issues that I care about, like climate change and access to transit, have already been talked about. So I'm going to talk for a second about making sure that our kids can get to school safely. Where I lived in Phoenix or South Medford, every morning I would have to see tiny little kids sprinting across 99 because there are no streetlights, there's no sidewalks, there's no bike lanes. And to get to the bus, they had to run across 99, which is a terrifying street to cross if you're an adult, and especially if you're a child. And so we need to figure out how to make our transportation system work for kids. And also on 99, every day I would see my neighbor in a wheelchair have to go down 99 because there are no sidewalks, there are no bike lanes, and it's incredibly unsafe also for drivers. Drivers have to swerve out of the way to miss people in wheelchairs. They have to swerve out of the way to miss bikers. And it's unsafe for construction workers. It's unsafe for a lot of folks in our community. So we need to figure out how to make our roads safer for everybody. We also, it was really exciting to see our transportation, Rogue Valley Transit, expand this last year. We have a lot of youth that volunteer for the organization that I work for, folks who don't have access to driver's licenses, and on the weekends there's really no options for them to get anywhere besides maybe on a bike, or if they have parents who aren't working on the weekends who can drive them, which a lot of our kids, that's not a their parents work on weekends, or they can't drive them across the valley to get to other activities. And so it really limits our youth's options to volunteer, to work, or to have access to opportunities. So we need to expand our transportation. We need to make our roads safer. And then we also, you know, our resources in Southern Oregon, our resources in the state are limited. So we really need to make sure that we are investing smartly and not spending a lot of money on really sexy, confusing overpasses and new bridges, and instead really making sure that we are investing in maintaining our infrastructure and investing long-term in the jobs also that come with maintaining our infrastructure, but fixing it first before really investing in confusing overpasses. And then the last thing that I want to say is that having walkable, bikeable, drivable, wheelchairable, accessible transportation is also a really important thing to making sure that businesses locate in our communities. A lot of young people that I grew up with are leaving our communities because there's not a lot of jobs here, and having access to smart transportation and a visionary transportation plan means that businesses will locate here and attract the young talent that we need to keep folks in our communities.
Hello, my name is Lucero Castañeda, and I work with Unite Oregon, and transportation has been a very important issue to us for a very, very long time, and we continue to see the needs in our community not being met. I myself use the bus on a day-to-day basis. It's the way I get to work. It's the way I'm able to get the groceries that I need, go to medical appointments, visit family in the area, and take care of my parents. And so for me, it's something that's viable. It's not an option or a choice, but it's a need. something that I need every day for my family, and for the transportation system that we have not to be accessible or affordable to many in our community, youth, folks who are elderly, disabled folks, it's really a problem. We need to make sure that our transportation has more routes. It takes way too long to get from point A to point B. Along Highway 99 to get to Ashland, we need a faster way to get folks to and back from school, work opportunities, from White City on the 62. Driving a car, personalized vehicle, is really the best way to do it. There isn't any options for walking, bikes. It's really not a choice. It's not an option at all. On the Highway 99, I myself have to cross that scary intersection every day. It's dangerous. It's quite dangerous. And it's not at all acceptable for people to be doing that, hundreds of people doing that on a day-to-day basis. And when I was growing up here, going to middle school and high school, I would walk along Highway 99 to get to my high school because there weren't any sidewalks. After school activities, the buses weren't available any longer, so I would have to walk along cars who were going 45, 50, 60 miles an hour, and I was 2 feet away. And so we need to make sure that these things are being addressed, and the need for public transportation is increasing. It's not accessible. It's not affordable. People have a lot of barriers for health concerns, economic concerns. People are not able to obtain driver's license in our state and rely on public transportation that isn't offered on Sundays. After 8:30 at night, there isn't any way for people to get back from work, do things that they need to do, make sure that their kids have the things that they need to be able to thrive in our community. I went to college in Eugene, and the public transportation there is a huge shift from what I see in the Rogue Valley. Things are more accessible over there. And to come back to where I grew up is really difficult to do the day-to-day things that we need to do. And elementary school children are having to walk in these dangerous areas is completely unacceptable. We need to make sure that these things are addressed and that we focus on transportation as a whole issue and not solely on roads, bridges, on things that are business-focused, but we understand the needs of the community that rely on this day-to-day effort. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hi there. My name's Robert Crowley. I'm a retiree. I live in Gold Hill. And I just want to go on the record, first of all, incorporate by reference everything Mr. Myers said regarding this whole climate change-driven policy basis that we have in this state, which, as far as I'm concerned, has been an absolute disaster for the people in this state, economically, socially, and otherwise. I hear a lot about the science. I have two empirical science degrees, one of them in wildlife biology and the other in forestry, and looked into this, and it disturbs me in a lot of the literature between what's actually said in the literature and these hyped up, I don't know what you want to call it, sales pitches or whatever, that Chicken Little, the sky's going to fall in, we better hurry up, we don't have time, et cetera. You can't really extrapolate that out of a lot of the information, including NOAA's sea level related to the Midway Island out there. There's another scientist, Kench, University of Auckland, who went out and studied all of these little Micronesian nations. They were supposed to be flooded out by rising tides and everything due to the melting ice cap. That didn't happen. As a matter of fact, the opposite's happening. And you can go along with correlate the carbon emissions that come off a cooling period that ended in 1975. There's absolutely no correlation between them and any kind of climate change going up. We are solar driven as far as climate goes. And from the ice core studies that I've seen published out of Greenland, referencing oxygen 18, which is a radioactive isotope they use to measure it, the actual temperature on that puts us halfway between the medieval warming period, the peak, as it were, and the bottom end of the Little Ice Age. Now, look, if humanity survived and thrived with the medieval warming period, which is obviously the case, we got through the Little Ice Age, surely on a warming trend in between those two periods, we're not in any trouble. There's no immediate crisis. I'm sorry. It just isn't there. And I fully appreciate these young ladies and everybody else, the need for public transportation and alternative means for people with disabilities. But in your consideration for transportation, our vehicles that we have, privately owned vehicles and commercial 18-wheelers, have been the backbone of our whole civilization and prosperity. And to start substituting and waging some kind of war on this based on this so-called science and everything they do, I'll tell you what. You go home, Google this up, a man named Maurice Strong. He's a billionaire. And he ran the UN's climate summits and things. Look at some of his statements, that the whole thing and thrust of this whole movement is redistribution of the wealth. Now, that's science, all right, but unfortunately it's political science, not empirical science. And I'm afraid with our computer modeling base, this is what is driving a lot of this. And I'll close with this. Your big threat you're going to find to the people in this state is not so much this climate change, as everybody's saying. I'll be blunt with you. It's the grid. That is the number one drop-dead killer we're facing. That thing goes down, and you people up there in Portland, and I realize rural Oregon hasn't really gotten too much consideration out of things. Boy, that goes down. You folks are in real serious trouble, as we all are, but more so. And there's a number of factors that are going on into that. As far as the money goes to fund the transportation needs we have, I would suggest to you that you really rethink the forest practices that we've got in this state. And yes, I know it's challenging the federal government, but somebody's going to have to do it and stand up to this insanity and malpractice of what's been done to our forests, frankly, with all the undergrowth. This thing catches, you're going to have a real problem on your hands. So we can reinstitute our forest industries in these rural counties that we have, and I think you'll find ample funding coming off those receipts to do the things you need to do. And by funding, I mean reinstitute Oregon-based, local-owned, where that capital is going to stay in the state and not go overseas with all these transnational concerns. So basically, just some thought, food for thought. Maybe we could lure you folks back here on the subject of the grid sometime. Okay, I want to thank you folks for your time and coming down and patience. I see you're all getting tired of this thing, and it's getting late, so I'll close.
Thank you very much. And it seems like we've ran out of people who wanted to speak at the same time we were supposed to leave the room. So thank you very much for coming here. This is, as I said, the seventh time. We've got three more to go. And we appreciate you taking the time to come out tonight. And with that, we will adjourn this hearing.